turn this over to Paul. Let Paul come around here and put his opening on for you. We appreciate WEFT and all of its volunteers, management, to try to keep us. You know, they're trying to buy up all the radio stations. Are you aware of that? So some madness is going on. So we want to.
Breitbart overall.
Yes, we got to keep our radio stations, community radio stations.
It's amazing.
So anyway, this is me. Sister Carol is leaving out of higher ground, and you're going to News from Neptune, and Paul will take care of you.
A little feverish. Stay coolish, folks.
Yes, sir.
I don't say stay cool because I don't know that it's possible, but if you stay a little bit coolish, you might make it.
Oh, well, blessings to you, sir.
Now, do we have any cooling centers around town that we know of? I guess
it's not posted up there, but you know, of course, the hospitals, the libraries, all
right.
of those are cooling centers. The city hall is a cooling center.
Right.
We want people
Lincoln
to take
Square.
Advantage of it.
It's a good place, I guess. All right, say hi to Aaron.
Will do. Peace,
okay.
Love.
What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Yeah, I got to use my favorite line about people say, help America first. It's like, well, Brazil is part of America. Mexico is part of North America. We need a new discourse, that's for sure. We're arrogant enough to abrogate the whole name. Isn't that amazing? So what's the rundown? I mentioned Ryan Devereaux. Got an article by him voiced on the spoken words. It's only 10 minutes long. I don't like to go too far into that phenomena of playing podcasts, but I know a lot of people listen to them. Interesting, we have some faux economics. You know, you've heard of fake news. Well, faux is fake in French. Are false, same. And Jeff Foe, who his son is a mover and shaker in this town, is with the Economic Policy Institute, and he's going to talk about the economic background of all of this. He talks about dumping federally subsidized corn on the Mexican economy. That happened after NAFTA. It was called a free trade. Free Trade Act, but one of its main provisos was shipping corn that was subsidized. So, you know, he who controls the language. A woman who's got a book out called The Threshold, Jeff Foe is, go back to where you came from. He probably came from Quebec, his family does. He's a Mainer. So, since that's the language of discourse. Sonali Kolhatkar is a native... Not Native American, she's continental Indian extraction. I think she was born in the U.S. So, and she has an interview with a person who may not be a naturalized citizen, but we should stop telling people to go back to where they came from. Amy Goodman's commentary is The Squad. She's going to have her discourse on that. Let's see. Okay, I think I ran down it all, except for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that's what we'll start with. The Raids Cometh. So he's on about this, too. I think he'll probably make a historical analogy. If you haven't heard, he's got a new trial for the basic murder charge that he's in jail for. But a couple of weeks ago, his commentary was that he's losing his vision. Can't recognize faces. I hope he can read for a while and they get some aids to him so he can keep reading, because he's a voracious reader and writer. It really saddens me that he's in that situation. And so I think we're ready to kick it with that right now, momentarily. I'll mention again, views and opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Tom Painter Memorial is happening. Sad, and I haven't really grappled with it as well as I should have as yet. Tomorrow, 2 to 6, I'll be back here at 5, unless I make some arrangements for it. A lot of people are coming in. Well, some people met somebody in from Seattle and somebody in from New Orleans for this memorial. That's at the Iron Post, who are also hosting a benefit beginning of August, so... We're a fortnight away from that. Already 5 minutes in, I've got a lot of great stuff to play here. I think I commend it to your attention. As like I said, they're not as feverish and flushed as I am right now. I guess I'm in a rather cool environment presently. Brakes are failing left and right on my vehicles. All I have is my scooter. It has a reliable brake.
The raids cometh. America has always had periods of state violence, attacks against dreaded others, people who were considered alien to a false white norm. Thus, the Palmer Raids of the early 20th century, named for the then Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, 1919-1921, targeted activist and radical Jews for deportation to Soviet Russia. The infamous and unjust incarceration in U.S. concentration camps of Japanese Americans during the 1940s and the targeting of black revolutionaries during the 60s and 70s for internal repression. Today, the targets are Latinos from the lands south of the U.S. These people are being demonized and criminalized to make their expulsions and deportations more politically acceptable. And the reason is as simple as 1, 2, 3. White fear of an emerging brown America. Today's raids had their beginning on the staircase of Trump Tower when the candidate announced his candidacy with a now infamous anti-Mexican screed. From then to now, can be drawn as a straight line. It is the crass stoking and exploitation of white anxiety and fear. We shall see if it works this time as it did the first time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
President Trump redefines White House. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Donald Trump has given new meaning to the White House. From his perch at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, he hurls racist epithets via tweet while commanding armed agents to terrorize immigrants at the border and in communities from coast to coast. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi summed it up well, commenting last week about Trump's attempts to insert a citizenship question into the U.S. Census, even after he was rebuffed by the Supreme Court. She accused Trump of trying to make America white again. It's well known that Trump is a voracious consumer of Fox News. On Sunday morning, just 20 minutes after Fox and Friends ran a piece attacking Congressmembers Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib, Trump tweeted, quote, "So interesting to see progressive Democrat congresswomen, who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, loudly and viciously telling the people of the United States how our government is to be run. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came?" the president tweeted. Go back to where you came from? Three of the congresswomen he attacked were born in the United States. Ocasio-Cortez, born in the Bronx, is the youngest woman ever to serve in Congress. Ayanna Pressley, born in Cincinnati, is the first African-American congresswoman to represent Massachusetts. Rashida Tlaib, born in Detroit, is Palestinian-American. She and Ilhan Omar are the first Muslim women ever elected to Congress. Omar is also the first congresswoman to wear a hijab. Born in Somalia, she came to the U.S. as a political refugee when she was a child. As one viral video pointed out, Omar has been a U.S. citizen longer than Trump's third wife, First Lady Melania Trump, a native of Slovenia. Trump's racist tweets united a fractured Democratic Party, quickly mobilizing support for the four freshman congresswomen now referred to collectively as the Squad. By Tuesday, a resolution, House Res 489, condemning President Trump's racist comments directed at members of Congress, was being debated on the House floor. Republicans temporarily derailed the debate by invoking an obscure line contained in the congressional rules that states, quote, "references to racial or other discrimination on the part of the president are not in order," unquote. The original rulebook banning the use of the word racist was written by Thomas Jefferson, himself a slave owner, but any irony in that was apparently lost on the Republicans. The resolution ultimately passed with four Republicans Republicans voting with a Democratic majority. While it was the first formal House rebuke of a sitting president in over 100 years, a more serious motion to censure Trump was blocked by Pelosi. Trump doubled down on his verbal assaults on the four congresswomen, accusing them of being socialists or communists. Trump's use of McCarthy-era attacks should surprise no one, as his early mentor was Roy Cohen, who served as Senator Joseph McCarthy's lead attorney when destroying thousands of lives through red-baiting during the 1950s. President Trump went to North Carolina Wednesday night to hold a campaign rally. Once again, he went after his favorite targets, women and people of color, telegraphing what will likely be a strategy of using racist rhetoric to inflame his white base. In the midst of his long tirade directed against Ilhan Omar, the crowd began chanting, "Send her back, send her back." In his book, The Black History of the White House, American University professor Clarence Lussain chronicles the history of the presidential mansion, from the slaves forced to build it to the first African-American presidential family, the Obamas. Lussain writes, "For many African-Americans, the white of the White House has meant more than just the building's color. It symbolized the hue and source of dehumanizing cruelty, domination, and exclusion that has defined the long narrative of whites' relations to people of color in the United States," Professor Lussain writes. On Monday, the four congresswomen who so clearly threatened Trump held a news conference denouncing his racism towards them and people of color overall, pointing to his policies on migrant detention, family separation, and threatened ICE raids. Refusing to mention Trump by name, Congressmember Ayanna Pressley made clear whose country this is.
"Despite the occupant of the White House attempts to marginalize us and to silence us, please know that we are more than four people. We ran on a mandate to advocate for and to represent those ignored, left out, and left behind. Our squad is big. Our squad includes any person committed to building a more equitable and just world. And that is the work that we want to get back to. And given the size of this squad and this great nation, we cannot, we will not be silenced."
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Indeed, breaking the sound barrier. If you want to hear the entire press conference the squad gave, Amy aired it, was that just yesterday? I've been reading the things like The Wire and The Daily Caller, because some people I know post things from it all the time, and they talked about it being a meltdown, which it wasn't. The only thing I have to do is the emphasis by, I believe it was Ilhan Omar, of Russian influence. I don't discount Russian meddling, but I don't think it was pivotal. I think the vote was stolen in the three states where the Electoral College totals made the difference. Let's see, Joe Loria's got a little debate somewhere. I might have to play that. He's took over for the great Bob Perry with Consortium News. Go away. All right, not you, listener. Thank you. Let me see. 2010, 50 minutes. Maybe we'll make this. I'll try to have an announcement or two. Let's listen first to this article by Ryan Devereaux with The Intercepted. And in this, he claims that it was they, not ProPublica, that outed this closed, private
Facebook. Now, Joel Bainan is on the phone from...
Yeah, irrepressible... Philip Muldery. That was another day. So, again, this is about 10 minutes long. It's well worth your attention. And it outs the guy that put up the most obnoxious, and I haven't looked at all of them, the most perverse, the one that shows photoshopped image of Trump forcing Ocasio-Cortez onto his crotch. Yeah. Got 246 likes on this. I guess there were 10,000 people involved. 74% have left. But the premise of this article is right here at the top, and I'll just let them voice that.
Welcome to the spoken edition of The Intercept.
Border Patrol Chief Carla Provost was a member of Secret Facebook Group by Ryan Devereaux. When news broke that thousands of current and former Border Patrol agents were members of a secret Facebook group filled with racist, vulgar, and sexist content, Carla Provost, chief of the agency, was quick to respond. "These posts are completely inappropriate and contrary to the honor and integrity I see and expect from our agents day in and day out," Provost said in a statement. "Any employees found to have violated our standards of conduct will be held accountable." For Provost, a veteran of the Border Patrol who was named head of the agency in August 2018, the group's existence and content should have come as no surprise. 3 months after her appointment to chief, Provost herself had posted in the group, then known as I'm 1015, now archived as America First Times 2. Provost's comment was innocuous, a friendly clapback against a group member who questioned her rise to the top of Border Patrol, but her participation in the group, which she since left, raises serious questions. Provost is one of several Border Patrol supervisors The Intercept has identified as current or former participants in the secret Facebook group, including chief patrol agents overseeing whole Border Patrol sectors, multiple patrol agents in charge of individual stations, and ranking officials in the Border Patrol's union who've enjoyed direct access to President Donald Trump. It's technically possible that someone else posted in the group using the individual's accounts. The group's existence has already generated at least two investigations from lawmakers and internal Department of Homeland Security oversight bodies. Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat, Mississippi, chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, sent a letter to the DHS Inspector General's office last week specifically requesting that investigators examine whether Provost and acting DHS Secretary Kevin McAleenan knew about or had previously addressed the problem of government personnel posting, quote, violent, racist, misogynistic comments and pictures in the I'm 1015 group. This is why I've requested a full investigation into this matter, Thompson said in a statement to The Intercept after being informed of Provost's participation in the group. We need to know who in CBP leadership knew about these deplorable groups, when they did find out, and what action they took, if anything. Customs and Border Protection, the agency that oversees the Border Patrol, didn't dispute that Provost and other senior agents had commented in the group. Provost didn't respond to a request for comment. In a statement, CBP said its Office of Professional Responsibility is investigating the material provided to CBP this week from multiple sources. CBP does not tolerate misconduct on or off duty and will hold those who violate our code of conduct accountable, the statement said. Several CBP employees have received cease and desist letters, and several of those have been placed on administrative duties pending the results of the investigation. These posts do not reflect the core values of the agency and do not reflect the vast majority of employees who conduct themselves professionally and honorably every day on and off duty. ProPublica was the first to report the existence of the secret Border Patrol group on July 1st, revealing that members use the page to joke about migrant deaths and share sexually violent and threatening posts about several Democratic lawmakers, including, in particular, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat, New York. Politico followed up by reporting that senior officials in the Border Patrol, as well as CBP public affairs officials, had known about the group for years and used it as an intelligence stream to monitor the sentiment of the workforce. The Intercept then reported that the public revelation sparked an internal purging of the Facebook group's content, but not before we archived hundreds of posts shared over multiple weeks. CBP's press office disputed reporting that it had monitored the group. While the agency has taken appropriate action to review, investigate, and caution employees about inappropriate posts brought to our attention, the agency does not restrict employees from affiliating through social media groups, a spokesperson told The Intercept in an email. Further, contrary to previous media reports, CBP's Office of Public Affairs does not continuously monitor the personal use of social media by CBP employees. Evidence of Provost's participation in the secret Border Patrol group comes as Ocasio-Cortez, along with Representatives Veronica Escobar, Democrat, Texas, Rashida Tlaib, Democrat, Michigan, and Ayanna Pressley, Democrat, Massachusetts, headed into a hearing with the Committee on Oversight and Reform and the Inspectors General of DHS and the Department of Health and Human Services on Friday to discuss their recent visit to detention centers along the border. As both ProPublica and The Intercept have reported, the lawmakers' visit was a hot topic among the I'm 1015 members, who discussed throwing burritos at the members of Congress, or, in the case of one El Paso-based agent, staging a, quote, bang-in to relieve stress from their presence. In a statement to the press Wednesday, Representative Elijah Cummings, the chair of the Oversight Committee, said the Facebook group would be a topic of discussion at the hearing. The Maryland Democrat has opened an investigation into the group and, in a letter to Mark Zuckerberg, requested that the Facebook executive see to it that his company, quote, preserve all documents, communications, and other data related to the I'm 1015 group, including log files and metadata. Shortly after the Facebook group was revealed, CBP's Office of Professional Responsibility issued a public statement citing Provost, saying that it had alerted the DHS Inspector General's office and that an investigation had been launched. McAleenan later said that an unspecified number of individuals had been placed on administrative duties following the disclosures over the last week, while ABC News obtained an internal memo showing that CBP, quote, was aware as early as February 2018 of at least one private Facebook group that included inappropriate and offensive posts by its personnel. Whether the group in question was I'm 1015 is unclear. As CNN reported last week, CBP employees have also participated in a group known as the Real CBP Nation that shared similar content to the Border Patrol group. A CBP spokesperson told The Intercept that, quote, it investigated and took action regarding specific inappropriate social media posts and associated individuals that the agency was made aware of in 2016, and that OPR distributed guidance to the workforce that warned CBP employees can be disciplined for inappropriate social media posts, including posts in private groups, in February 2018. As for current investigations, the spokesperson said, several employees have been placed on administrative duty, also known as restricted duty. The cases are still being investigated. When the facts are ascertained in the investigative process, the report is reviewed to determine whether the case should be heard by the agency's disciplinary review board or referred to local management for review under management's disciplinary authority. We cannot comment on individual cases. Catering to current and former Border Patrol agents and other CBP employees, the I'm 1015 group had more than 9,500 members before being exposed. As of Friday morning, the number was a little over 4,000. Though efforts were made to remove recent disturbing content, much of the group's past posts and comment sections remain intact, with the names of members who have left the group appearing in gray. The names of three current chief patrol agents appeared in the Intercept search of the Border Patrol Facebook group, including Matthew Hudak of the Big Bend sector, whose last post was on August 10, 2016, Rodney S. Scott of the San Diego sector, who remains in the group and whose last post was on November 17, 2018, and Jason D. Owens, former deputy chief patrol agent for the Laredo, Texas sector, who now oversees operations for the Border Patrol's Houlton sector in Maine. The Intercept additionally identified nine current or former group members whose names match current patrol agents in charge, or PAICs, of individual Border Patrol stations. The names of Border Patrol union members also appear in the group, including Hector Garza, who was among the first active duty agency members to establish a relationship to then-candidate Trump in 2015, and Tucson chapter union head Art Del Cueto, host of the Breitbart-sponsored Border Patrol union podcast The Green Line and frequent Fox News guest. While posts shared by Border Patrol supervisors viewed by The Intercept were generally benign, that wasn't true in all cases. By all indications, group member Thomas Hendricks was something of an edgy meme lord in I'm 1015, never cowering before the politically correct demands of so-called snowflakes. When Hendricks appeared to disappear from the group last summer, his stature and mystique grew, prompting "Who is Tom Hendricks?" and "We are all Tom Hendricks"-style posts. The truth, as ProPublica reported this week, and as comments reviewed by The Intercept indicate, is that Hendricks appears to be a supervisor in the Border Patrol Calexico station with more than two decades on the job. He returned to I'm 1015 on June 21st, posting, "That's right, bitches, the masses have spoken, and today democracy won. I have returned. To everyone who knows the real me and had my back, I say thank you. To everyone else, this is what I have to say." Hendricks then included an image of a smirking Trump forcing Ocasio-Cortez's face into his crotch by the back of her neck. The post, which garnered more than 250 likes, was on the ProPublica website less than 2 weeks later.
So, despite the fact that AOC asked the head of, was it Homeland Security? I forget, DHS, if he could identify the person that put up that post, journalists knew. And his vigorous investigation of it is, well, not at all. Okay, that's from The Intercept, Ryan Devereaux. He's the guy that really broke the story, and he's been doing some great work on border and immigration issues for the last couple of years through Intercepted. Through Intercept. Intercepted's on holiday. Jeremy Scahill, maybe he's off in Croatia again since he likes it so much. I commend your attention to the last one that he put up, which was an interview with a Croatian political scientist, I believe, sociologist maybe. Anyway, I want to put a sock in it and mention a couple of things. This afternoon, free, 12 to 4, and the, I think, Climatized Canopy Club, the Illinois Student Youth Music Camp, the Hip Hop and Rock Camp student show. Last year, Brandon Washington was the instructor for hip hop, so I don't know if he's doing it again this year. But the students would be well served if he was. So that's all afternoon, 2 to 4:30 at the Canopy Club, and it's free. They want to pack the place, which will tax their air conditioning. Also this afternoon, solar devices at Anita Purvis Nature Center. I just heard about a new one. In the UK, they have a device that monitors whether you're using all of the electricity your PV devices are making, and diverts excess to a heating element in your water heater. So I don't know if they have sell-back provinces, but you usually don't get the true value of the product when you're selling back to the utility company. And I don't know what the details of that. That would be a question to ask these folks. I forget what it's called now, but it's a nifty dice. Maybe I can remember that. Sounds at Sunset, a new park I've never heard of, way north of Wilbur Heights, in some of that condo development north along Market Street. You can find it's Tolson Park. This is a musical event, and it's appropriately named Hot Iron String Band. So I hope they can keep their instruments in tune. So it's north of the 7457 interchange even, so way up there. If you want to explore a park, if maybe there'll be a relief in the temperature by then. All right, we're not going to make it. No, let's see, we might make it. Mentioned again, top of the hour, Jeff Foe, father of Tom Foe, who's with C4A, doing a lot of great work in community school and music and performance. His father is a Mainer who helped start the Economic Policy Institute, and Kevin Pena. That'll be the last segment, though. So a better introduction is Sonali Kalhatar with a woman whose name I won't try to pronounce. And they should go back to where they came from, too, don't you think? Okay. Let's just kick it. This is a new thing. I'm contacting her, and we'll see what we can do about it. It's a morning show out on the left coast, so I think it's 8 a.m. our time. And it's on TV as well, Free Speech TV. Sonali Kalhatar, probably some people in the community have seen her product. Great stuff.
PFK Pacific Hour Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kalhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacific Hour Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The U.S.-Mexico border is more politicized today than in recent memory. With President Donald Trump's rallying election campaign cry to build a wall, he has banked on the criminalization of immigrants and traded on racist stereotypes. As a result, the practical impact on the border has been deadly. A former volunteer emergency responder at the U.S.-Mexico border writes in searing detail how our policies have resulted in serious injuries and deaths at the border, with little to no impact on the actual reasons why people are attempting to enter the U.S. or how they finally make it through. Her name is Yeva Yusonite. She is an assistant professor of anthropology and social studies at Harvard University. Her earlier book was Savage Frontier, Making News and Security on the Argentine Border. And she's trained and volunteered as an emergency medical technician, paramedic, and wildland firefighter in Florida, Arizona, and Massachusetts. And her book is called Threshold, Emergency Responders on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Welcome to the program, Yeva.
Hello, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about what role you played on the U.S.-Mexico border. Tell me exactly what you did at the border and what the experiences were that formed the basis of this book.
So I'm an anthropologist, and I had studied other borders and other issues in South America. But when I came to the U.S.-Mexico border, and the reason why I was interested in going there is to see how emergency responders in northern Mexico and in southern United States work together despite the increasing border fortification and militarization. So when I arrived, I both did ethnographic research. I had a grant from the National Science Foundation. So I interviewed a lot of paramedics.
And what period, what time period were you there at the border, by the way?
So I arrived in, I started in 2015, and my research ended in about 2017, I would say. Mm-hmm. So for most of 2015 and 16, I was also there as a volunteer firefighter, emergency medical technician, paramedic in Arizona as well as in Sonora. So I had this dual role, a dual responsibility.
So a lot of the research you did was around the or under the Obama administration, then the first-hand research, I should say.
That's correct. I actually, when the presidential campaign started in 2015 and when current President Trump announced he was running, I was already in the field. So it was mostly under Obama's administration.
So the walls that do exist at the border, and we have hundreds of miles of actual wall at the border, despite what Trump says, how do those actually work in terms of keeping people at bay and the injuries that they cause?
So the first walls or fences really came up somewhere longer in early 20th century, but the wall building really started in the 1990s during Clinton administration. And the first walls that were built were made of these landing mats that originally were used to land cargo airplanes and helicopters in Vietnam War. So they were not very tall, 8 to 12 feet. They were not see-through. People would climb over them in urban areas and often got their fingers amputated or other kinds of injuries to their hands, but they could climb over or cut through the fence. In 2011, which was following Bush's administration passing of the Secure Fence Act in 2006 and appropriation of more funds for different types of walls, they built more fences, and these were taller, up to 20 feet above the ground, made from what you might have heard of being called as slats or bollards. So these are see-through structures they are much taller, and as the infrastructure changed, so this is the mechanism of trauma. So we also started seeing, the paramedics on the border started seeing different types of injuries, people who climb from the current fence. And the last person to die, I think, was just in June in the Nogales area where I was. People who fall, they usually fracture their ankles or their legs, often hurt their spines or have different head injuries. So the man who died in June, he hit his head. And I think he was the fourth person to die in the recent years that we know of. A lot of these statistics are not reported and not known.
Has the U.S. government actually studied the impact that walls on the border have, both on injuries and deaths and on enforcing immigration laws?
In the Border Patrol documents, if you look at their evolution through the years, they do mention that they know that building fences in urban areas, for example, make crossing the border more difficult. So what migrants or asylum seekers usually do is they try to go around urban areas. They travel through the desert or swim across the Rio Grande River, or sometimes pay the smugglers to be helped up a ladder on the Mexican side and then either slide down or sometimes fall. So the U.S. government, the Border Patrol, knows that this is the term they use in the documents for the border fence is tactical infrastructure. So it's part of the infrastructure that's to be deployed to make the entrance into the United States without authorization harder and to deter people from coming. The policy is named prevention through deterrence. But again, since just building walls doesn't address any reasons why people are coming, it hasn't really stopped them. It has only rerouted them to go through different areas. At first, a lot of people used to go through Tijuana, San Diego, later Ciudad Juarez, El Paso area. They were pushed to Arizona, now again to Texas. So it really depends who is coming from where and what kind of enforcements are on the border.
Tell me about Ankle Alley on the border.
So the Ankle Alley, it was in Douglas, Arizona. I was with the chief of the local fire department, Mario Novoa, and several of his paramedics. And he said, he took me to the border fence. A lot of these communities, a lot of these towns have very similar border fences. And he said, we are called there to pick up people with broken ankles so often that they started calling the cement ledge that abuts the international border wall as the Ankle Alley. It is just the most common mechanism of injury. When I interviewed trauma surgeons at the Tucson Medical Center, which is the only level one trauma facility in that region where a lot of most seriously injured people are flown by helicopter because there might be not enough time to take them by ambulance. It might be an hour, 2 hours or more. So the surgeons also said they also recognize these patterns of injury. And most of it, if you fall from a height, it could be a tree or a fence. The first impact is to your feet. And then you either fracture your ankles or legs and spine. The impact travels up your body.
What sorts of stories or relationships, I should say, did you witness between emergency responders on the opposite sides of the border? Emergency responders are there to, they're trained in saving lives. They're there to do a triage often, right? I mean, they're basically, the goal is to take emergency action to save a life. And yet those that are more, the majority of those deployed to the border are there to ensure no one crosses or to take people into custody and not necessarily ensure their well-being, although on paper they're supposed to. So I'm wondering whether relationships develop between emergency responders across the border.
So it's such an important question. And we need to understand that in the United States, you have different agencies. So when I am talking about emergency responders, I'm usually talking about the municipal volunteer fire departments who also run ambulance services. And they have excellent relationships with the Mexican emergency responders. A lot of them are friends or brothers, their families. Many of them are Mexican Americans who have families on both sides, who work on both sides, whose children go to schools on both sides. But there is also the Border Patrol. So I did not study the emergency medical technicians that work for the Border Patrol. Some of the agents are trained to provide first aid. I encountered a lot of them in the field, but they are there, again, as you mentioned, their primary task is to enforce the laws and take people who do not have authorization to be in the country into the custody. The emergency responders I worked with, they do not care whether they provide aid to what nationality or what legal status or what even criminal background people who receive aid have. They have their medical ethics rule first. So in the field, we were often called by the Border Patrol because they would be the first ones who would encounter injured people either in the desert, dehydrated and lost, or by the border fence, or in the Border Patrol detention centers or their Border Patrol stations where they were so-called processing migrants. So So they would call the ambulance because the Border Patrol doesn't have ambulances, and we would come as emergency medical responders to the Border Patrol facilities and take the patients, drive them to the hospital from there. And the relationships between these local communities and emergency responders and the federal agents who are Border Patrol are pretty diplomatic. They're on good working relationships, but there's also a lot of tension because the same Border Patrol agents often stop emergency responders at the checkpoints on the roads. They profile them as question their being in this country as Americans, unfortunately.
So emergency responders get profiled by Border Patrol?
Yes, they are being stopped even when they drive fire trucks and being asked, did you steal this truck or are you really an employee of the local fire department? It is very unfortunate, and it has been going on for a few years.
So are there instances where emergencies require responders to cross the border from where they work to reach a hospital that might be closer by if someone's life is in danger?
Yes. So very often they work together, emergency responders in Mexico and in the U.S. in situations of natural emergencies and disasters, such as floods and wildland fires. For patients who are in Mexico, it's usually the better equipped and the closer hospitals are in Arizona. In Sonora, Mexico, they are further away. So people who have very serious injuries, it doesn't matter. They might be Mexican citizens or they might be American citizens, retirees living in Mexico or tourists visiting. If the injury happens in Mexico, there are certain protocols of how those people are being taken into the hospital into the United States. And the Border Patrol, the Customs and Border Protection have designated lanes for ambulances to meet Mexican and U.S. ambulances and exchange patients. And sometimes the Mexican ambulance is allowed to go into the U.S. with an escort and take the patient, especially if it's a child, if it's in an incubator, or if a person is connected to breathing equipment. They don't want to disconnect that at the border, and then they bring the patient into the United States. They haven't been really going the other way. Doesn't happen that often, if at all.
I want to go back to this idea that the border infrastructure has not contributed to stemming the flow of migrants, but has contributed primarily to simply injuries and deaths, or more injuries and deaths. The family separation policies that the Trump administration took last year, it made it very clear that the whole point of that was deterrence, you know, to basically make it as hard as possible on migrants so that word doesn't spread that they could come into the U.S. and have a great life, that they would pay this price. It's almost like extracting a pound of flesh as punishment so that people, you know, who haven't yet crossed would think twice. And I'm wondering if you think that there is this mentality, a similar mentality around making the border more and more treacherous because it could, you know, because raising the possibility of injury is the idea.
Absolutely. And until now, I've been talking about physical injuries, but especially what is happening with family separation, it's more of a psychological trauma, some of which is evident almost immediately when we see the pictures that these children who have been kept away from the parents draw that the American Association of Pediatrics shared. And we don't really know or understand what will be the long-term effects of such such policies and such practices. It is definitely discouraging some people from going all the way to the U.S.-Mexico border to seek asylum. There are some people who decide to ask for asylum in other countries or in Mexico or even Guatemala because they are afraid of being separated from their children. But again, it is very hard to see the bigger picture. We only know individual stories. And a lot of people who are fleeing those countries, especially if it's because of violence, they do not have another possibility. It's almost they have to risk it. Some of them don't know what might happen. Of course, a lot of media coverage now makes the news reach the communities back in Central America and in Mexico and elsewhere. But again, people are risking their lives already, and they think that the children will have a better chance of life eventually, even if they have to endure this separation. So unfortunately, it is part of this prevention through deterrence package. It's psychological warfare.
The U.S. military has been deployed in varying numbers and at various times over the past couple of years to the U.S.-Mexico border as well. What is the impact of the U.S. military been and some of what it's been told to do, which is applying concertina wire on top of the border fences? What impact has that had on the well-being of migrants?
So it had the primary impact of the concertina wire, I would say, was on the border communities. For example, Nogales, Arizona, Nogales, Sonora, they are sister cities. Again, everyone crosses the border almost every day for either work or leisure or shopping. And having concertina wire in the middle of the community, when I went there, I was completely shocked. And people were shocked because it makes them feel like either side is in prison. It's not really sure which side is in prison. The mayors of the local cities in Arizona, Nogales, Arizona, asked for this concertina wire to be removed. It really, the sense in the community is very bad. For the migrants, the smugglers find ways to cut the concertina wire, just like evade any other obstacles in their way. The person, for example, who got killed in trying to climb the fence in Nogales in June, he did have a gash from the concertina wire, so it does injure some people. But otherwise, the military don't really stay in the community. They live in their bases. They come, sometimes they spend a lot of dollars in local stores, but even that, it's not necessarily a benefit. If the tax base of a lot of these communities in southern Arizona comes from Mexican shoppers crossing the border into Arizona, and if they are discouraged to come because of how they are treated in this country, then these communities in southern Arizona are losing a lot of money that funds schools, that funds municipal services, the same emergency services. So it's we often talk about border militarization and what it does for migrants and asylum seekers, but really bad, it really does hurt the communities that straddle this border, and that has straddled it for over 100 years before the border fence even existed.
We've heard stories of how Border Patrol or ICE agents, you know, have this attitude towards refugees and migrants that's so dehumanizing. There was the ProPublica report about Border Patrol agents, current and former, you know, exchanging the most horrific racist and sexist, misogynist memes with one another and messages. And I'm wondering if that relationship between Border Patrol and migrants is just set up to be dehumanizing and is really quite a contrast with the relationship between emergency responders and migrants, because emergency responders necessarily have to see the people whose lives they are saving as human beings, just like them. Americans and Mexicans or Central Americans, you know, are all human beings ultimately.
That's the interviewer, Sonali Kalhatar from Rising Up with Sonali. It's a free speech TV show out of KPFK, interviewing there Aiva Yusinieta, who has a book out, Savage Frontier, not about our border, which she would argue probably is, Making News and Security on the Argentine Border. Makes me think that she might be originally from there. She especially is working with emergency response people and that stuff about the border. Her new book is Threshold, Emergency Responders on the U.S.-Mexico Border. And I'm going to cut it right there and say you can find that on the podcast, Rising Up with Sonali. Hear the rest of it. Go on with another issue, sort of another roots issue. And that's with, again, Jeff Foes, Tom Foes' father, and people in my listening audience might know Tom. He's with the Economic Policy Institute. He will be introduced by Kevin Pena, so why don't I just let him do it? Opinions are those of the speakers. And I think we're going to go right to it. Maybe I'll have an announcement on the outro. A lot of stuff hanging in the air. As you know, I hadn't really thought of the emergency response aspect of this. One hears about the water bringers and the trial of the guy, the retrial of the guy who got some kind of felony littering, amongst other things, aiding and abetting migrants. The other bit of busy work, not busy work, Doug Henwood coming up, Puerto Rico and Turkey. Very timely stories on both. An economic and political crisis in Puerto Rico with Bemat Tort. That means wrong in French. And Saban Karatasli on the Turkey situation. That's behind the news, the latest edition of Doug Henwood's show. And Here's Jeff Foe of the Economic Policy Institute, though I didn't have to tell you that, did I? Thanks for listening.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, where we're going to continue our discussion about Trump's immigration policies and about the history of immigration policy in the United States. And I always like to focus on the connection between, there's a lot to be said that there's a direct connection between U.S. foreign policy, particularly in what's called the Northern Triangle in Central America, that's El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and how those countries were destabilized historically by successive U.S. presidencies. But underneath all of that, of course, is U.S. economic policy. And these three things are connected, and our next guest is going to help us to understand their connection. His name is Jeff Foe. He's the founding president and distinguished fellow of the Economic Policy Institute. Mr. Foe, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, sir.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Great to be here.
Well, let's just start with the connection between U.S. economic policy and what's going on with the innumerable people who are trying to come to this country.
Yeah, well, obviously the surge in immigration is a worldwide phenomenon for many reasons. But here in the Western Hemisphere, the U.S. foreign policy, which is very connected, as you say, to economic policy, is a very, very important factor. And it's, you know, you have to ask this question. Well, these countries have been, you know, impoverished and people have struggled for decades and decades. Why all of a sudden, you know, do we have this surge of people who are fleeing and then want to come to the United States? And part of it is U.S. economic policy, with trade policy. Used to be that that the United States simply traded as a, you know, a matter of normal business, imported what we didn't make and exported to earn the money to pay for the imports. It was useful, modest, but beginning in the 80s, there was a big shift to, you know, what is now obviously known as neoliberalism. And U.S. trade policy was aimed at letting U.S. companies produce abroad with cheap labor. Now, we all know that that drove wages down here. What's less known is how it destabilized communities and workers in the cheaper, you know, the countries where labor was inexpensive. I mean, the first big example that we saw was in NAFTA, the trade deal with Mexico. It allowed American agribusiness, subsidized, by the way, by the U.S. government, to flood Mexico with cheap corn, destroying the jobs and livelihoods of several million Mexican farmers. Now, at that time, we were told, don't worry, they'll just get jobs in all these factories that U.S. companies are investing in. So when they were driven off the farms, they tried to find work, especially along the Maquiladora, in the Maquiladora factories along the U.S. border. And what they found there was low wages, big surprise, because that was the whole point of NAFTA, and terrible working conditions. So they were, you know, driven north, and then they were driven across the border. And they come across the border, and obviously these are desperate people. They're willing to work for less, which aggravates tensions with the, you know, native-born American workers who are unemployed or working at low wages because of NAFTA. So it's not only a economic phenomenon, then it aggravates the politics. And, of course, that's what Trump exploited, especially in those states that he won in the Midwest.
Now, of course, we could also make the argument that that kind of economic policy, which really prefers elites, it doesn't really, let's face it, transnational capital, U.S. capital is more comfortable working with economic elites in those countries. And a lot of those
It's not just that it's more comfortable, it's essential, because they're interested in the low wages and they need the elites and the police and the army to keep down, to keep out labor unions.
And that's my point, is that you can't just say that it's because for economic reasons, because that kind of economic policy leads and generates human rights abuses through enforcement to maintain the power of those local elites.
That's absolutely right, and that's what's been going on in Mexico and Central America.
Haiti?
Haiti, I mean, you practically name it. But, you know, these countries are very, very close. And there's another channel how this works, and that is, again, NAFTA is a great example because NAFTA is the model, the neoliberal model. And NAFTA opened up the border, our border, to illegal as well as legal trade. So it created huge drug profits in Central America. It used to be that the cocaine, for example, came from Colombia, went through the Caribbean and up the East Coast. Well, when they opened up NAFTA, it was a lot cheaper to ship those drugs right through Mexico into and Central America into the U.S. So the profits were huge. It corrupted the governments, who were sort of low-level corruption before this, and then spawned these criminal organizations, which have preyed on the local population and terrorized them, and forcing them to flee. So, you know, the deal is, and so what? So why, one asks, if, you know, all this is detrimental to the United States in terms of what we're seeing at the border and all that. Why do we persist? Well, we persist because it's both U.S. political and economic interest to keep these corrupt regimes in power. And you probably know the story of what happened in Honduras in 2009.
Right, Manuel Zelaya, right?
Here we had an elected president, right? We're the country of freedom and democracy. Here we had an elected president who was a member of the elite, but he was a little bit of a maverick, and he wanted to do a little bit for his people. I mean, he was no radical, right? He wanted, you know, like school lunches and things like that for the kids. And the elite would have none of it. And, you know, one night in 2009, they got the military to come to the presidential palace. They abducted him, took him to an American airbase in Honduras, an American airbase, and then, you know, got him out of the country. And every country in Latin America, including for the first day or two, the United States condemned it. And then, you know, the powers that be got to the Obama administration, I have to say that, Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton just turned around and pulled out the rug from under those countries that wanted to bring back this guy because he was democratically elected. And, you know, the military installed their own regime. And it's been a mess ever since. And after that happened, within the next 2 years, the immigration from Honduras, knocking at the U.S. border, went sky high. The number of children who suddenly appeared at the border, and it was a direct result of what we did in Honduras. And there's almost no calling this to account. And I think it's one of the reasons, well, it may be one of the reasons, that the Democrats are so skittish about this. You know, they say, oh, yeah, you know, we have to do something for Central America. But, you know, there's no push behind that. There's no push behind that because, you know, they're influenced by these companies as well.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Jeff Foe. He's the founding president and distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. We're talking about sort of a web here of connections between U.S. foreign policy, U.S. economic policy, and mass immigration into the United States, attempts of people fleeing repression in those countries, fleeing poor economic conditions to try to clamor to get into the United States. Well, I'm reminded of 1991 as well, the coup against Aristide. Remember, they had to set up the Chrome Detention Center on Guantanamo Bay because of the huge number of refugees that U.S.-backed coup created. Then a similar circumstance occurred in 2004 after he was removed a second time. And back to this thing about elites, though, which is that U.S. economic policy, and it seems, I guess we're going to label it neoliberal policy, often defines the elite as the quote-unquote private sector. And the private sector is always said to be the primary motor of economic development in the country. But it seems like a real misnomer because, in fact, those elites seem to be entrenched oligarchies who, in fact, who don't tolerate real free market capitalism. In fact, they try to maintain monopolies over power.
Yeah, and they do it by making sure there's no free labor movement. They use the army. I mean, they use the paramilitaries to murder and chase away the labor organizers. And, you know, obviously, you know, they don't put any money out for education or that kind of stuff. And they want to keep their own workers cheap so they can continue to be the middleman for big international capital. In other words, if you want to expand your textile business and here's Honduras, they got cheap labor. Well, they got a little bit of an instant political instability and people get murdered, but you want to be sure that your factory is safe. Well, who do you deal with? You deal with the president of the republic, and you deal with the chief of staff, and you deal with their paramilitaries, and you pay them, and they'll keep you safe.
Isn't it also true that mostly, and what we've seen is that those economic elites in places like El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Haiti, throughout Latin America, in fact, that when they do turn a profit by virtue of these partnerships with international corporations, they don't really invest the money back into new businesses or their own economy, that in fact, most of that money ends up in banks, in foreign banks, and largely in U.S. banks.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador are small countries. Okay, we understand that. But there's still, you know, they still produce things. There's still money there, and that gets siphoned off. And the nature of that kind of, quote, capitalism, unquote, is that it's predatory. It just sucks the wealth out of those countries, and not a lot of wealth, but there's some there, sucks it out there and sends it to Miami and London and other places. And there's a class, I mean, there's a very much a class issue here. I remember years ago when they were debating NAFTA, and I was opposed to it with my friends in the labor union and others. And so a lobbyist for the Business Roundtable gets me in the hall of the Capitol, and she says, she's giving me the spiel why I should, you know, why I should be for and after. And then she says, we have to support Salinas. Right? Carlos Salinas was the president of Mexico at the time,
right,
and a big business guy. Family was in drugs as well. And then she says, he's one of us. And I tell you, I didn't know what she was talking about. One of us, how can I? I have no relationship to the president of Mexico. But thinking about it later, I realized what it was, that she assumed that there was this class of international, I don't know, use the Russian word, apparatchiks, who served these people. And
mid-level managers.
Because I went to college, that we were all in this together.
Right. Mid-level managers, right? These are the apparatchiks.
Yeah, yeah.
The guys in the suits who protect these guys. Because, well, first of all, I just want to make sure that we're talking the same language here, that I'm understanding you correctly. Really what you're saying is that neoliberalism is an economic policy that was made on behalf of and to benefit predatory elites.
Yes. And there have always been predatory elites. I mean, you know, the history of the United States is full of labor-capital disputes and that kind of thing. But what the globalization did, you know, the capitalists in America had to keep most of their money here. They had to deal with labor sooner or later. They had to accept the New Deal because this is where they made their money. And what, beginning with NAFTA and then the WTO and then the deal with China and then, you know, what they tried to do with the TPP and all these other trade deals, they prevailed on both Republicans and Democrats to open up the economy to this global corporate financial world so they could ship their money elsewhere, produce elsewhere, and bring it back here and sell it. And then they didn't need workers here. What they needed was workers anywhere who would work for less.
And their natural allies were the oligarchies of other countries and the elites of other countries.
Yeah, and those are the guys. Those are the guys who suppress, you know, labor in those countries. Keep the workers down.
So
make sure they're cheap.
So I don't mean to interrupt, but I got to get to the point. This other point here, which is, so President Trump makes this big idea about how he breaks with the deep state, how he breaks with neoliberalism.
Yeah.
But in fact, what you're telling me is that his fundamental economic policy does also still represent the economic elite, predatory elite of this country. It's just under a different guise.
Yeah, and the difference between Trump and Obama, Clinton, the two George Bushes, Reagan, you know, where all this stuff started, is that, you know, Trump, as we know, is this crazy egomaniac, and God knows what he's really thinking. But fundamentally, he's in the pocket of these same people. He is one of those.
So is it just like another, just a different school of the elite, a different crowd of the elite, but they're still part of the same, really the same club?
This is sort of the more thuggish part of the elite. And they, you know, they tried to stop him. I mean, even the Republicans during the Republican primaries of 2016, not because they thought his basic point was bad, but because they couldn't trust him. He was a little wild, and they still feel that way. But think of this: what did he do for them? Massive tax cuts, massive evisceration of the regulatory system in this country, and so you know they'll put up with this guy. And because in the end, he's giving them what he wants, and he's giving them what they want because he's part of them.
We're talking with Jeff Foh today. He's the founding president, distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. We're talking about really the connection between U.S. economic policy, U.S. foreign policy, and the current immigration crisis, if they want to call it that, which is largely a result of those policies. I guess finally, I just want to ask, what you're saying is that the kernel of Trump's immigration policy, this hardening, this sort of acknowledgement, open acknowledgement of its racist core in many ways, is not too far afield from what the Democrats did, that in fact it's systemic, that it's still part of the same game that's being played, just a different school of the elite playing it.
Yeah, it is systemic, and that's absolutely right. It doesn't mean that I won't vote for any Democrat who runs against Trump, because I will. But we should not kid ourselves that, you know, somehow or other, this was fundamentally different. You know, let me give you an example of foreign policy. They keep calling Trump an isolationist. Well, Jesus, he sent a missile to bomb Syria. He's, you know, he's on the verge of war with Iran. He's been trying to undercut the government of Venezuela.
China.
He's strengthening the U.S. forces in the South China Sea. Now, if you look at a map, you know, the South China Sea is as close to China as the Caribbean is here. You know, how would we react to aircraft carriers and Chinese destroyers in the Caribbean? So it's the same deal. The United States is in 100, depending on how you count it, 160, 170 countries in the world. We have military presence there. Does the average American even think about this? And yet, in all of these places, we could be sucked into another one of these Afghanistan or Iraq. So, yeah, the face has changed. The script is the melody's a little, or maybe I say the words may be different, but the music's the same.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Fascinating discussion with Jeff Foe, founding president and distinguished fellow of the Economic Policy Institute. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today here on Flashpoint.
Oh, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
And now let's go ahead.
And that was Kevin Pena filling in for the hopefully poetry writing Dennis Bernstein show us Flashpoints from the 7th and fills out the whole